Think of Dagestan, and you might picture rugged mountains, ancient stone towers, and remote villages. And you wouldn't be wrong. But today, we're going to discover a different side to the Southern Republic. Our first stop is Sulak Canyon, one of the oldest and deepest in Europe. The vibrant turquoise water that carves its way through the cliffs makes for a pretty surreal sight. And what gives the water this sort of wonderfully milky turquoise colour? And what's the best time of day to see it in all its glory?
The colour of the water depends on the presence of minerals, carbonates in particular, such as limestone. The waterbed consists entirely of limestone. On top of that, the Sulak River is fed by mountain rivers, which also carry certain crystalline sediments, such as quartz. If we were to go to the reservoir nearby, while the water level is still low, and took a walk on the exposed bottom of the reservoir, we'd find a lot of quartz under our feet, a lot of quartz. Quartz particles create this milky hue in the water.
And is it best in the morning to come here and see it, or in the evening during the sunset?
Different strokes, as they say. At noon, when the sun is high in the sky, the light is brighter. On the other hand, when the sun sets, it illuminates these cliffs, which reflect the light onto the river, resulting in a softer glow that brings out turquoise hues. The water has a greenish tint right now, but later, when the sun emerges from behind the clouds, it will become more turquoise and blue.
And what's your favorite time of day to see the canyon?
Before noon.
Right, okay.
Before noon, this is the ideal time.
When the speedboats aren't bombing it past like this one here, it's quite a peaceful and tranquil place, but I guess you also shouldn't be lured into a false sense of security here. It's still a canyon, it must be dangerous.
For starters, there are 5 hydroelectric power plants on the Sulak, which are known as the Sulak HPP Cascade. The uppermost stage is the Cherkesskaya HPP, which has one of the tallest arch dams in the country. It's over there, upstream. If, God forbid, this dam broke, a terrible disaster would strike.
I guess here in Dagestan, in general, you must have mixed feelings about the water here. On the one hand, you have these wonderful rivers, lakes, and the Caspian Sea nearby, these beautiful natural water bodies. But on the other hand, I know the region suffers from devastating floods that can wipe out entire villages.
We do get flooded sometimes. Just recently, we had a devastating flood after record-breaking rainfall. We haven't seen anything like it in the past 50 years. It has to do with climate change. Several villages were flooded.
Are there places in this canyon that you can swim, or is the water too fast-flowing and maybe cold?
You could swim, but not right now.
Right, okay. Well, I don't have my shorts with me anyway.
You can go swimming in summer, but it depends on your physical condition. The water is so cold, it could end badly. You could drown.
I guess you have glaciers here as well that feed this river.
Yes. We've come here to taste the cleanest and most delicious water you've ever drunk. I've no doubt about it.
Okay, let's try. I'll believe you.
Yeah.
It tastes good.
Okay, and what are the health benefits of this water, Shamil? That is extremely fresh.
Yes.
Extremely fresh.
Yeah.
It's almost like it should be bottled.
Yeah.
And what are the health benefits of drinking moss water?
Well, it does quench your thirst, that's for sure.
Well, that's certainly true. And now, right in the middle of this harsh, rocky landscape, is something you wouldn't expect to find. An orchard bursting with fruit.
As a true Englishman in Dagestan, why don't we start from tea? You don't mind?
Sounds perfect. No, I don't mind.
It's not a typical English tea. It's a Dagestan village herbal tea.
Okay.
So...
Because I'm not the biggest fan of classic English tea,
you're
as you know.
You're the first Englishman I can see who is not fan of English tea.
So, that's quite the pouring skill you have there, come on.
They say, like, tea with pach-pach. Cheers.
Well, cheers. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
But it's definitely better than English tea, I'll tell you that.
That's quite a compliment from an Englishman.
Good, good.
Thank you.
Now, you've lived both in Dubai and Hong Kong. Why did you come back? What could you find here that those places couldn't offer you?
Of course, first of all, it's family. Right. We are in Dagestan, we traditionally have traditional, very strong bonds with our families. It was this garden, like orchard, and fruit orchard from my father and forefathers. So, and again, it was my daughter who was, we were divorced, like it's quite a personal story, and I was divorced with my first wife, and it was my daughter, and I didn't want it to be like online father.
You know? No, of course. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And it turns out to be the blessing. Mm. So when I returned home and started this family business here.
Mm. Well, can we take a closer look?
Absolutely. So yeah, why don't we take a walk and go on.
Sounds superb.
Yeah, thank you.
I've heard that the humidity and the temperature near the canyon, they can fluctuate wildly. Does that not make it difficult to grow such delicate fruits as
peaches?
Yeah,
you know, sometimes we had a unique, like, microclimate for this kind of, like, the hundreds of years, we know from the historical evidence.
Right.
That these villages around here, they were harvesting and they were, growing the apricots, peaches.
Yeah.
And grapes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It makes it like unique flavor. And this sometimes, you're right, these fluctuations of the humidity and especially in the end of March, beginning of April, when the trees, they begin like the open, like blooming.
Yeah.
And then from the first sunny days and then again some cold temperature like drops. And then it makes sometimes we even... as they do it in the south of France and Italy sometimes, in the between the grape rows, they burn the fires.
Yes, yeah, to keep them warm.
To keep it warm, especially because in the winter, in the midnight times, and when it drops like for the whole night, when it drops up to -2, then your harvest is gone.
Yeah, wow.
So, like, we have very few, like, this kind of days here, but sometimes it's dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess the ground beneath our feet as well must imbue the fruits here with a unique sort of flavour profile. What does the ground here give them that, say, you know, they couldn't get elsewhere?
You mean in Dagestan or in this place?
This literally the soil, does it? Yeah,
of course.
Soil here.
Yeah, it's soil, and again, the important thing as a human being, like the fruit trees, we consider them as a living organisms. And the purest water, like the glacier water from the Sulak, which is like from 200 meters from us, they drink the Sulak water. And that's the most biggest advice. As we say, you are what you eat.
Yep.
And you are what you drink.
Yeah.
So... And our fruits are what they drink, and they drink the purest and the most delicious sweet water in the world.
I don't even drink that. Well, Kamal, thanks so much for the tea and for a lovely evening stroll
Absolutely.
Through your wonderful Peter. Orchard
you're
today.
You're welcome.
Thank
Always
you so much.
Anytime.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
And now for something a bit different. A machine so fearsome and unusual, the Americans called it the Caspian Sea Monster. As long as a seven-story building and the only one of its kind ever built, let's meet the Loon Ekranoplan. Ali Gaji, you can imagine when people first saw this back in the day, they'd go, it's a ship. No, it's a plane. And then they'd scratch their heads and they'd say, no, I don't know what on earth this thing is. What exactly is an akranoplan?
The ship travels on water. Plane flies in the sky. And this thing moves between both, just 3 to 5 meters above the water's surface, using ground effect. It was designed for stealth. It can reach a speed of up to 500 kilometers per hour, flying at a very low altitude. It was deployed by rapid response forces. The Lun ground effect plane was meant to help disable strike groups, such as carrier strike groups. It can approach from 1,000 kilometers, strike at 500 kilometers, and then return.
Impressive. So that's where the vehicle gets its name from, the ground effect plane.
The ground effect is achieved between takeoff and a height of 10 meters. It could fly higher in plane mode. However, that means proportionately greater fuel consumption. If you want to achieve better economy and increase range, you could take advantage of ground effect, like a cushion of air. In plane mode, range drops to 700 to 800 kilometers. That's how far it could fly and come back. But as a ground effect vehicle, it can go as far as 1,500 to 2,000 kilometers. You see the difference.
And this particular akranoplan is called Lun. Where does that come from?
The earlier and smaller akranoplan was called Arlyanok, or Eagle Chick, alluding to the hawk family. But that was just the start. This one is a louder and more formidable bird, which is why it was called Lun, or Harrier. The Harrier can approach undetected, snatch its prey, and fly away. This aircraft was built to destroy prey.
Got you.
The name Lun was a logical follow-on from Arlyanok. They went through a number of options like Berkut, Golden Eagle, Karshun, Kite, and so on.
So all birds?
All birds from the hawk family. However, the chief designer picked Lun, which is a small and very agile bird, which is how this akranoplan got its name.
It's not actually that small, is it, Ali Gaji?
No, it's not. It's as high as a 3- or 4-story building. Inside, it has 3 decks. When fueled for maximum range, flying with all missiles and so on, it would need 120 tons of kerosene. Refueling would take all day from morning to evening, and we'd go on a 4- to 6-hour flight.
Really?
Yes.
Amazing.
That's what made it special.
That's remarkable. Is there any chance we can take an even closer look at this beast?
Let's go over and take a look.
Superb. So what sort of speeds could it reach and how high would it cruise above the water?
It could fly as fast as 500 kilometers per hour and reach a height of up to 100 meters above the water.
100 meters above the water?
When using ground effect, it was highly maneuverable and consumed significantly less fuel.
Got you.
Its main advantage was being a low-flying, fast-moving target.
So you lose the ground effect at such heights?
Yes.
Okay. And was it stable in flight? Yeah.
Of course, the most challenging stages of flight were takeoff and landing. Flying, in contrast, was a walk in the park. Yes, all you had to do was keep an eye on the instruments. The navigator and flight engineer would be busy, but otherwise it would be smooth sailing.
And turning around, banking to each side?
Sure. We did all that.
Amazing.
No problem. Let's get inside and see what's there. It'll be more exciting than here.
But you'd never ask. The ground effect principle needs, I guess, a relatively flat surface to trap the air. Does that mean that you couldn't take this out in stormy weather or in rough seas?
We could, and we did. 2.5 or 3 meters is nothing for the Lun akranoplan. Just small bumps in the road.
Is that it?
It's a tank that flies.
Amazing. And tell me, Ali Gaji, how did it feel taking the controls of something that looks like it could be straight out of a comic book?
It was the pilots who did the flying. But I felt proud for my country and myself for operating this kind of technology. Few people get a chance like that.
I felt I was among a chosen few. There were just 20 of us in the crew. I was lucky to get a chance to fly ground effect vehicles and test them with our guys. I'd say I'm a very lucky man.
Ali Gadji, can you show me your station aboard this Ekranoplan, please?
It's close. Let's walk over there and I'll show you how it was all done.
Excellent. Now I see a panel here with dozens of gauges, buttons, levers. What is this responsible for and which button is the most important?
There's no single most important button. They're all important. This is the engine control system. Throttle levers. Roughly speaking, they're like the throttle and brake pedals in a car. Apart from that, these gauges show you the RPM, engine temperature, fuel consumption rate, and distance traveled.
Right.
The navigator calculated the time to approach the target.
Now, this Ekranoplan has sat disused for decades. Do you think that if it were restored, there'd be any chance that it could take flight again?
No, this one can't be restored. It would be easier to build a new one. But there's a new Ekranoplan in Nizhny Novgorod, which was intended to serve as a rescue vehicle. It's a powerful aircraft of the same size, capable of operating in the open sea. It can get out there, pick up people, and come back. There are also smaller passenger Ekranoplans.
Where's the big red button, Ali Gadji?
There's a small red button.
Oh!
It's here. It was used to launch the missiles on hearing the command, open fire. The navigator provided the coordinates. The operators acquired the target. The commander, sitting over there, gave the command, and the officer manning this position launched the missiles.
Wow. So you think the Ekranoplan has a bright future still?
It has. But it would take an enthusiastic leader, and you'd need to act fast while the passionate engineers who can design these things are still alive.
And finally, for a leisurely sail out on the Caspian Sea, which, despite its name and size, is technically the largest lake on the planet. I'm going to start with a very daft question, Pir Murad. It's called the Caspian Sea, but it is in fact the world's largest lake. Why do we still call it a sea then?
It's true that thousands of years ago, even the Persians and the Arabs called it a sea. How is a sea different from a lake? A sea is supposed to be connected to the world's oceans. The Caspian Sea isn't. More than 130 rivers flow into the Caspian, but none flow out.
Right.
A sea is supposed to be connected to the ocean at least by a strait, a passage, a man-made canal, anything. The Caspian doesn't have that. It's a landlocked body of water. Technically, it's a lake.
Right, okay.
However, economically speaking, it is a sea.
Despite being fed by over 130 rivers, as you said, the Caspian Sea is still shrinking at an alarming rate. What's causing that?
In the past 3 years, 2023 to 25, we saw a disastrous drop in the seawater level, which affects the marine fauna. Spawning grounds are shrinking as the sea recedes, since spawning usually happens in shallow waters near the shores. The main reason is the lack of water in the rivers. Our southern region has been affected by severe droughts. Some rivers don't look like rivers anymore.
Murad, have you noticed the sea shrinking here?
Yes, I've noticed that our Caspian Sea has become much shallower, reducing our catch sizes. I think it has to do with global warming, which has led to a dramatic drop in the sea level. There are also many sewage pipes that pollute the sea and disrupt natural fish development cycles. Poachers are another problem. They fish unsustainably so that fish stocks can't replenish themselves quickly enough. These, in my opinion, are the main factors that explain our poor catch sizes and the low water level.
And I see you've still not caught anything either.
I haven't caught anything. Still hoping.
Yeah. Well, yeah. As they say in Russian, hope dies last. Rasmurad, I've also heard that there are areas in the Caspian Sea, these dead zones, where there's basically no oxygen and therefore no life. What causes them?
Right. In 2018, scientists from Kazakhstan discovered a dead zone near the Kazakhstan shore. The reason it's called a dead zone is that there's no life there. No plankton, no fauna, nothing. It's all due to global warming and the declining sea levels. Shallow areas emerge where water temperatures can reach 40 to 50 degrees. Fish and other living organisms experience oxygen deprivation in such areas, which turn into dead zones. Looks like it's biting.
I think I've got another one. Here we are. Right. Oh, no.
What have you got there?
Oh, there we are. Hey! What a beauty! It's not the biggest one, but I think you'll do.
Looks
for
like.
First go. Look at that.
Looks
what's,
good.
What have I caught? What's this fish?
To use the correct term, it's a roach, but it's known as tarashka around here.
Okay.
What wobbler?
Well, I'm fairly happy with that.
You should release it because there's been a ban on roach fishing since 24. We'll release it into its natural habitat now.
Yeah, I think we'll do that. Yeah. Will you mind helping me?
Sure. Before it gets hurt.
Uh-huh.
And off it goes.
That's one to me and zero to you, Murad.
Our fisherman is lagging behind.
Despite the fact that I don't know how to word this. What's that?
Right here, yes. Release the line and close the bail.
Uh-huh. Right. Let's see if we can catch anything else then. Well, Murad, the neighbouring countries here, Iran, Azerbaijan, they have all sorts of beliefs that monsters inhabit the depths of the Caspian Sea, like the Caspian monsters and the Rûn Shah. Have you ever seen any strange goings on while you've been out here fishing, Murad?
I caught a mermaid once.
Oh, really?
I let her go.
Oh, really? Okay. I'm sure she was very grateful. How about you?
Here's what I can say about the Caspian monster. There was a vessel known as the Caspian monster put on display near Kaspisk. It was the Lunj vessel.
I know that one.
That was its nickname. It could travel both on land and sea. There's another explanation. My guess is that people might have called beluga sturgeon the Caspian monster. Belugas can weigh more than a ton. Some specimens would weigh as much as 1,200 kilos.
Really?
So that's probably where this talk of monsters came from.
You're not winding me up now.
I'm not. Of course it's true. There were belugas like that in the 1800s and early 1900s. The most recent specimen I saw, and I have a photo to prove it, weighed 137 kilos.
Okay. Still pretty big. Beluga, though. Mm-hmm. So do you think there's still hope for the Caspian Sea, then?
Yes, we'll never lose hope. What's our purpose on this planet? We must preserve nature. We must strive to keep the Caspian Sea alive. It was here a million years ago, and it must survive. We must do our utmost to replenish its waters and biological resources.
There's hope if we all do our part to protect our nature and environment. If we don't pollute the sea and the environment, everything, I believe, will be fine again.
Well, me too. Cheers, Murad. Thank you very much. Phil Murad, thank you so much. Both of you for taking me out fishing today. I still can't help but notice that you've not caught anything, Murad.
I decided to let you have it all.
So, Murad, when your fortunes are better than today, what's the biggest fish you've ever caught here?
It was a long time ago. I caught a carp this big. It weighed 18 kilograms. It was quite a catch.
Impressive. Do you have one of those pictures of you holding it like that?
I could find it.
Okay.